Hello. Welcome to Blacter. Join me as I examine the best of black artists in my quest to becoming one myself. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Blacter. I am here with Mr. Brandon Burton and Brandon Pierce. Hello, gentlemen.
How's it going?
Hi there.
Hello, hello. All right, so to get this conversation started, let's start with talking about where both of you went to college and what was your inspiration or drive to major in theater and acting.
Cool. So I went to undergrad at a really small school in Cedar Rapids, Iowa called Coe College. And my inspiration for doing theater, I think, was just that I was always the kid that was disrupting class in middle school. And then by the time I got to high school, one of my teachers just kind of threw me at the theater teacher, and they were doing A Winter's Tale, and the bug bit me. And that's kind of been it. And since high school and then Coe College, I moved to New York for a couple of years. And then I just graduated in May from the Yale School of Drama.
For me, I went to the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. I guess my drive was, I remember when I was a kid at one point, I was probably like five or something like that. And I just, for some reason, I was like, oh man, what would I be good at when I grow up? And I decided that would be an actor, because I thought that's what the kind of skills I had would be applied well to. Being a little weird kid who liked to do all sorts of odd voices and pretend and things like that. Yeah.
Cool. And so would you say that in, you know, educational theater and university theater, how were you able to find your place as a young black actor?
I would say certainly, I mean, in undergrad, it was kind of it was very like Chekhov and Chekhov and Ibsen and Brecht. It's a whole lot of like really older European theater. And that was sort of like, all right, cool. I just got to treat this as sort of a style of training and not necessarily believe that I'm being cut out of the picture. I did have the opportunity to perform The Dutchman in college, and that was really, really helpful. And then when it came to the educational aspects of Yale,
you want to start that sentence over?
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say it's kind of a perfect revving into it. But when it came to Brandon, are you in Philly right now?
I'm in New York right now. Yeah. I'm chilling at New York. I'm by a window. I will. You know what? I'm gonna shift where I am. So
but what's funny is you got that like Philly vibe with like the motorcycles in the background.
You know, like
the ATVs, you know what I mean?
So
when I went to Yale, I just sort of had to understand that I was stepping into the belly of the beast, as sort of say. I mean, like, Yale is named after a prominent slaveholder. It is easily a foothold of white supremacy in this country, if not in the globe. And so stepping into that environment, knowing that that's what I was stepping into, really helped me to understand what to expect and also what not to expect. Sort of knowing that like there are just certain behaviors that were going to come with the territory, and there was a choice to be made. Either I could allow those things to get in my way, or I could see past them and just continue keeping my head down and doing the work. Or if it got to a point, speak up and ask for systemic change, not just a sort of patchwork change in behavior.
I remember my freshman year of college, one of the upperclassmen came up to me and they were like, oh, another one, like another, a black upperclassman. Because I guess at that point, the school, it was, I think in my class, there was maybe four or five of us, maybe that freshman year. At least I know in the acting program, there was only me and one other person. I forget who was there musical theater wise that freshman year, but so it you know, there's definitely a feeling of I guess I would say isolation a bit, coupled with the isolation I was already feeling just like adjusting to college. It definitely made it less fun probably than I would have wanted it to be. You know, that's both on the school and on myself as well. But I you know, it took me a while in college to really sort of navigate that space of being like, I didn't have to just be the person who was doing black parts and stuff, you know? Like I had an assignment my junior year where we had to bring in a old school painting, and we had to sort of assume the form of that painting. And we were given a specific time frame, which in my mind I was like, I have to find a picture that's a black person, but in the time frame I'm in, I'm finding that extremely difficult. To which a teacher was like, you know, I apologized to me, because he was like, I should have made it clear that it didn't have to just be like that, because you could do any of these things. Which I'm like, oh yeah, you're right. I can do all this. I can compete with everybody. I don't know why I'm just looking at this in you know, one kind of way. And it was like, why am I looking at that kind of way? And it's just because, like, that's what you see, you know what I mean? So, you know, it took a while, I think, coming out of school to really like find that sort of individuality for myself in terms of everything that I could do. Because like Brandon was saying, you know, all those institutions, a lot of times you are working on those European pieces or pieces from like the 1950s or something like that. To which every time I was working on them, I understand now that I can do those pieces, but I definitely back then it kind of felt like, why am I going over this? I'm never going to get cast in any of this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even to the point of when we were learning, I think our sophomore year, we learned for voice class, we learned General American. which even now thinking about it, I'm like, I shudder a bit. Because it was like, for one thing, that's one of the few times working in theater where it was like someone was constantly telling me that they couldn't understand what I was saying. And for the most part, I usually am pretty articulate from what I'm told. And in that, it was always like, I can't understand what you're saying kind of thing. I'm like, what? And then I would like go and talk to like the head of acting, and he'd be all like, I don't sense any regionalisms or blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, I don't know why I'm failing this class. You know, like I had a teacher once say to me, that I remember she said some point about like black people have a southern way with which they speak or something like that, to which I made me feel uncomfortable. Making such a generalization. Those first 2 years of college definitely were weird, also because you also have teachers who don't know how to navigate those kind of things. At least then, I don't know if teachers are better now to a degree. You know,
That's all I'll say.
You know, because I was very quiet my first 2 years of college, and I remember in both years I had a teacher be like, instead of just seeing my quietness as who I am and as that being part of Brandon, they made a point of being like, I don't know if you would have, if it would be better if you had like a black teacher, if it was like the whole reason for how I was specifically just because I was black and that would fix it or something like that. Like when you're like a college student, at least for me, I didn't have the words to articulate how that was making me feel, or you know, to attack what they were throwing out with these microaggressions in some ways. So yeah, college is weird. A lot of times I imagine what it'd be like to go back in time and defend myself with the voice I have now.
Yeah. Brandon Burton, have you had any kind of interesting relationships with your professors and the fact that, you know, they necessarily didn't know whether it was how to speak to you or how to just navigate through what you were bringing to the table as a student?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, when I was going to school in Iowa, it was definitely that, like everything that, Mr. Pierce. It's weird when we say like that everything that Brandon said, because it feels like
it's like you're talking about yourself.
It's like, are we just all talking in third person on this call? Like, but like everything that Mr. Pierce, that sounds too formal, that Pierce said, rang very true. Cause I mean, it is that kind of thing where it's like, holy shit, like there's another one. Or in my case, I was the only one. And that was sort of like the thing that charged all of my white colleagues to be like, oh my God, we can do August Wilson now. And I was like, well, there's only one of me. I don't know if you guys are down to do like a one man August Wilson. That seems pretty aggressive. But, you know, once I got to Yale, it was a bit different because they were sort of on the cusp of restructuring how voice and speech were taught. Beth McGuire and Ron Carlos were my speech teachers, and even now they're changing the language of the class. It's going to be called like dialects and phonemes, I think. But you know, that we started with studying our own idiolects. So we started with learning how we sound, and the sort of coding there was that like how you sound is acceptable for Shakespeare, it's acceptable for Chekhov, it's acceptable for anything that you're cast in because that is who you are. And so there was very little ask for anyone to from jump adjust themselves. I mean, like we all learned IPA and we had to learn how to say those things. But even that was just taught more as another language as opposed to the way you should sound. Because no one actually does that shit. Like no one actually in life is conscious of raising their soft palate. Like no one, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like no one is actually like, it's just what happens when you're born in a place and people around you sound a specific way, your brain starts making those adjustments naturally to sound like them. And so that's how we were taught. And so that was, I feel really lucky in that respect. As well as, I mean, I think the only thing that really, where I really sort of butted heads was, again, that kind of, corrective behavior as opposed to corrective pedagogy. And by that, I mean, it's like, it's different for someone to sort of do something and then apologize for it later. As opposed to taking preventative measures to make sure they never even crossed that line in the first place. A pretty benign example of that is our clown teacher, Chris Bays, would always say y'all people folks, whenever he was calling everyone. And that was the best because I was like, oh, this dude is consciously making shifts. Because he used to say ladies and gentlemen, but now he just says y'all people folks. Yeah. And that's like the best adjustment you can make that seems really innocuous, but it is so inclusive. Mm-hmm. And he never has to get into any sort of conversation because the language that he's using while he's teaching shifts sort of the paradigm of the room. And there's a lot of training that happens at the school, and you know they're trying their best, but at the same time, it's a foothold for white, like it's a foothold for white supremacy. Like Skull and Bones was right next door to the university theater where a lot of us performed. Like these secret societies that pump out, you know, I mean James Bundy, whom I love. The dean of the school and the artistic director of the School of Drama, his dad, his daddy Bundy, was one of the architects of the Cold War. like I think that it would be, again, like any infractions that I felt, I mean, I'm kind of rambling now, but any infractions that I felt, I sort of came to expect because I was like, well, the institution doesn't really know any better because the institution was never built for bodies like me in the first place. You know, we're sort of trying to retrospectively fix the institution, but I'm like, no, the institution's built on the backs of black and brown bodies, and it will continue to operate so because that's how it maintains its power. And so I can't go in here expecting them to see me as fully human. I have to force them to see me as fully human. That is part of my task as someone who's accepting enrollment here. It did have a kind of funny incident happened where one of our teachers was telling a story of how she was teaching someone, she was coaching someone for a South African dialect. And she said that there was a word that was said in the script, and she, this teacher was trying in the coaching session was trying to figure out like the right, and this teacher is white, by the way. It's very important for later in the story. Yes. She's trying to figure out like an analogy for this particular word and how it translates to how, what it would mean if that same word were said in an American context. And she was like, it's kind of like saying nigger. It's like saying nigger. And so she's retelling the story to us and we're like, and so then she finishes the story with, and that was the moment when I learned I should never say the word nigger. I should never say the word nigger.
As she's saying it.
As she's saying it. And so then we're in like two groups, right? There's like eight of us who are in that class when it happens, and then another eight. And I was in the second group, then another eight who was in like a different class doing something else, and then we switch. And so in the switching time, the class that heard the story the first time was like, okay, so she told us the story, and we told her that maybe during the telling of the story, she shouldn't say the word. And then she was like, oh, you're right, I shouldn't do that. And so we were like sort of prepared for her to tell us the story, but hoping that maybe she would not say the word that she just said she learned not to say. And she told us the story, and she was like, yeah, and I learned how not to say. And she kind of looks around the room, nigger. And how what to say, nigger? And I just busted out laughing. I just started laughing. Because it was just like it's that sort of like feigned innocence, that sort of like sense of absolution, because I've gone to the altar in front of one group of Black people or brown people, that sort of absolves me from any further sin. And it's like, that's not how it works. And I think that more and more teachers are starting to learn and understand that simply because you apologize to one does not mean that you apologize to all, A, and B, your apology does not correct your behavior or your impulses. And that's the long answer to a very short question.
No, that's absolutely fine. Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate white directors, professors who are, you know, on the older side, who have been doing this stuff for the past 30 plus years, who are learning that they have to start adapting to the times and what's going on now, because especially, you know, where I go to school with the sales, they have not been used to having a lot of people of color, especially Black students in their college until, you know, probably 5-6 years ago, really, where more of us started coming there. So there's definitely, especially with this whole movement that's been going on since forever, since 2013, really, but making a bigger change this year, that their eyes are open now, and they're able to say, okay, we need to start changing our ways and start adapting to what's going on right now. Okay, so let's move on to life after college. So I know for Brandon Burton, you took a few years off before you went to graduate school. Is that correct?
That's completely correct.
Great. Just wanted to make sure I got that right. Yeah. And then Brandon Pierce, you've been out, doing regional theaters for a bit as well. So do both of you want to speak to how you kind of, I mean, this is a weird question, but how you looked for work after school, and what kind of auditions you went to off the bat?
Pierce, you want to take this one first?
Sure. Yeah, I can. I know for me, coming out of school, I had actually booked a gig in my my senior year of college at the Arden Theater. And I probably let that get to my head a little bit, thinking like, oh yeah, now I got a credit on my resume. I'm going to come out of the bat, out of the gate swinging. I'll be the best. I'll head everybody. didn't quite work out that way. That first year out of school was a lot of, you know, just like searching for gigs and, you know, really hustling, really. sending emailing people, seeing what open calls were out there, going up to New York. I think I actually went to a New Jersey open call at one point. Just pretty much trying to get to every audition I could get. And I think that first year, immediately afterwards, in 2012, I don't think I booked anything until 2013, I think, is when I first got something, which was working for the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey, doing like their Shakespeare tour, which they call Shakespeare Live. And which was actually my first time, I think, really doing Shakespeare, a production of Shakespeare. Which is always the weird thing with Shakespeare for me, and the weird thing with a lot of the pieces that I first got when I got out of college was it was those situations where it's like you're the only Black person there. So then you start to question, like, am I actually good, or are they just like, is this like a quota thing? I should rephrase that. That Shakespeare Theater in New Jersey job had, there's three of us that were Black on that show. But it still was like, I even now when I do Shakespeare, sometimes I question if I'm actually like doing good work or if it's just like, I'm Black and I'm here. And I can speak well. But those first few jobs, and especially those first few Shakespeares I was getting, did feel that way. Especially when you go to audition for something and all the people cast for that one particular part are people of color. And you're like, oh, well, I see that they're really determined that this is the part where someone of color is in it. And then you're the one person in it. A lot of just like emailing people, going to auditions, booking the job, sometimes making a connection in that job that leads to another gig. I was pretty fortunate that like once I got the ball rolling, things started to come my way. But it's also, at least in Philly anyway, it always kind of feels like people occupy certain slots. So there's like, there might be that one young lady who's like the non-equity young lady who gets all the young lady parts. Mm-hmm. Or there's, this is our top, equity Black guy who gets all these parts.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's like that in all the other cities or cities that are, regional towns like Philly. If they're all like that, but that's at least how it is in Philly, feels like. So it kind of felt like you're trying to like get a membership to the club. And once you get a membership, you're usually pretty good, but it can be frustrating trying to get that membership.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I sort of after college, was swimming in a sea of despair because I just wasn't getting any work. I moved to New York. I moved to this really big market, and I was doing a lot of like off, like way off Broadway, like the bottom, like the basements of churches and like, theater troupes that sort of like commandeered school auditoriums and just doing a lot of that kind of stuff. And it wasn't until I actually booked the mobile unit, the educational unit for PSF, that things started to pick up a bit for me. And even in that situation, they were doing a production of Mackers, and I was the only person of color on the entire cast. It was just fucking bizarre. Like, it was just like that same feeling that Pierce expressed of like, did I get this because I'm like, I earned it, or did I get it because I'm filling a quota? Like, mm-hmm. What the fuck is going on? And then after they sort of offered me they offered me some stuff on the main stage at PSF. And then I was like the only Black person, like one of two, I think, that first season that I was at PSF, I was like, okay, this ain't gonna work. for me, because like, because it's like you start seeing like, oh shit, like I really am just like filling some sort of a quota. And it's frustrating, especially when like, you know, the opening bell of every show is next season, we're considering the hit list. And I think that we can all say them at the same time. It's like Raisin in the Sun. And then we're gonna do, you know what I mean? It's like, we're gonna do Fences. And then like, if you're really like, if we're really being risky about it, we might do Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Like, it was kind of like, you know, sort of seeing, and this was not just at like that particular institution. It was at other institutions that I had either visited, like Shakespeare and Co, or at worked at. And I was just like, there's a lot of people who run, who are artistic directors of these theaters, and even at Yale to a degree, there's a lot of artistic directors who like to play it safe. And so they'll provide a lot of lip service. So they'll give the audience the safety net of, you know, we're talking about having these shows, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, you guys are safe as patrons, you know, as subscribers, like we're talking about it. So you can say that you're progressive in that way, but we ain't actually going to do it, you know? When the rubber meets the road, it's kind of, it's always, I would say 8 out of 10 times, they're not going to do it. And I didn't return to PSF after that first year because I was just like, well, I'm not going to come back until there's more people of color. The next time they asked me to come back, I was like, what are the shows you're doing? And they were like, well, our musical is Ragtime. And that's all they had to say. I was like, all right, cool. I'll be there because I was like, oh, cool. That means that like, it's not just going to be me. You know what I mean? Because in order to change these institutions, we have to be able to have these conversations together and figure out plans together. It's very difficult for one person sort of yelling into a white vacuum to try to, you know, get change to happen. So yeah, it was real rough. And then, you know, this year is kind of exceptional, but the plan was after graduating from Yale was to go back to PSF to do Fences. Right. And to possibly do either Henry or Midsummer. Mm-hmm. But then Mr. Rona came knocking and asked for some bills, and none of us were prepared to pay.
Yes.
So, you know, like things kind of shifted in that way. But yeah, it's tough. And I think it's also different because now there's a very real and very different dialogue happening about brown bodies in these historically white spaces. And that shift in conversation, I think, is the thing that will get us out of this sort of feeling of like, did I earn this or am I filling a quota sort of mentality? Because I think that right now we're asking for a higher, we're asking for a bit more accountability on the end of every artistic director, every producer. We're just asking for a bit more, and we can better articulate our demands because we've collectively developed a language because of the internet. So that's really helpful. But yeah, shit was rough a couple of years ago.
Yeah. I can definitely, I remember my first year at PSF, I also went through the same isolation, which I think was either like a year or 2 years after, I think, your first year, Brandon Burton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of just sort of, of being like, oh, I'm out here by myself. I'm in a part of Pennsylvania that also has a low black population.
As well as Trump flags. Like, that's also.
Oh, yes.
I remember my mom gave me a ride that first summer I was there. She's all like, you be careful out here. There's not a lot of us out here. And then, of course, you know, being there for the shows, there wasn't a lot of us there. I was the only person of color in my immediate age range, I believe. And I remember I felt so isolated there, just being new and just being like one of the only few black people there, until Akeem Davis showed up like a little later in the summer, and I was like, oh yes, now I have somebody. I don't feel so alone now.
Yeah.
And then of course that year that they did Ragtime, a couple years after that, I was like, oh wow, this is amazing. It's an abundance of black people here.
It's a bounty of black people.
Yeah, like it was,
Can you imagine that being my first year?
I was spoiled. God.
Oh, man. Crazy, yeah. Crazy times. But yeah, that was like a running joke. These are what we're considering, Raisin in the Sun. Yeah. And it was nice that they were going to do fences. And then, of course, you know, I guess Corona was like, nah.
Not this year.
Not this summer.
You know what the irony of that is? Is that I was in a production of A Raisin in the Sun when Mr. That's Rona right. came a knocking. And yeah. then I was also about to do Fences. And I was like, how the fuck did both of these shows that every theater in the country promises I was going to be in get canceled because of one fucking event? I was like, that's fucking, this is funny. Like, this is really funny. I didn't mean to cut you off.
It's funny. And you know what the sad thing about the whole thing is? I'm not trying to like knock PSF or any institution like that, but like, I know in some of those cases, it's like they worry about like being able to sell some of those productions.
Yeah.
Which to me sounds crazy because I'm like, is Raisin in the Sun hard to sell? I guess
it feels like it's the safest of the black plays.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's one everyone knows.
I mean, I get to agree. You have a predominantly white audience. And as Brandon Byrd alluded to, you know, Trump supporters out there as well. who might not, you know, be like, yeah, Raisin in the Sun, but still, I'm just kind of like, it's as you said, it's safe. It's like everybody, not everybody, but most people know what that is. I mean, people study it in high school and yada yada yada.
Yeah.
And I wonder if, to some degree, if it was like, yeah, we'll do Fences. There was a movie of that. People will know it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just it's whack.
Yeah. Yeah,
whack as fuck.
We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the episode. I think this is a good place to kind of go to talking about having a black playwright versus a white playwright, specifically white playwrights who write black and people of color characters for their plays or musicals or what have you. So have either of you been in a play where you've had a white playwright that you felt didn't depict our people correctly?
Yes. I mean, I've been lucky. I'd say I'm lucky in that, like, I haven't been in a play where I was like, yo, who the fuck wrote this? Because I'm going to beat their ass because this shit is wrong. But I've definitely seen a handful of plays from playwrights who are our contemporaries. Mm-hmm. Who were just, it's like disrespectful. I remember seeing one show at grad school where there was a superhero character of Middle Eastern descent, and it was bad. It was it was bad. It was just really, it was really rough. There was a point where someone like pulls out a Quran, but it's like, it's like a fucking schoolboy like loose leaf paper holder with like Quran written on. It was just bad. It was just like so disrespectful. Yeah, it's pretty rough. But that's my experience. I've only seen it.
Yeah, I don't know if I've been in a piece by a white playwright that I felt was disrespectful that I can think of. Mm-hmm. Actually, I had to like look up my resume to be like, who wrote that? I mean, those pieces are definitely out there, but I don't think I've necessarily been in one. I'm trying to actually think about it, 'cause I think there's only the only one that I can think of that I think I've only been in one piece by a white playwright where I was a character that was like specifically black.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, you know, kind of a it's one of my favorite shows that I did. It's called Dutch Masters.
And I do
like the play. But it was also a situation where it was like I was the one black person in the production. It's a two-hander. It's a white guy and a black guy. And those are always weird kind of things because then, you know, you're the authority. And I guess in even that case, even the authority over the playwright to some degree. So, you know, that's always a weird experience. But yeah, I don't think other than that, yeah.
What are your thoughts on white playwrights who say, no, I don't want the cast of the people in my particular play to be diverse. I want it to be how I wrote it. I want them all to be white. What are your thoughts on those playwrights who have those thoughts?
I think it's fine because generally those plays are trash. Like, no bullshit. Like I think that it's complete. Like, you as a playwright or director or cast, like, if that's like the mentality that you have, if you want it to be the thing that it is as written, and you want only, you know, white bodies in your play, that's fine. Because 9 out of 10 times, like, those plays suck. They suck. And so it's kind of like, yeah, dude, like, if you, you know, rock how you gonna rock, but know that, like, you're taking a major L in your production. And even still, it's like, if you don't want us, then we don't want you either. Like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, if you don't want us in there, that's fine, because we never wanted to be a part of it in the first place, if that's the way y'all want to roll with things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that definitely feels like in a on to the next one kind of situation.
Yeah.
There's a part of me that I guess I suppose I get it. If you really want to, like, try to find reason for something, and, you know, you can try and justify anything. And obviously there are some pieces that it might be weird, but you can always just, like, you know, not be prideful about it and just change some language around. But at the same time, it's like, those pieces that are like that, do we need to do those?
Right.
You know, there are obviously good plays that were written like 80 years ago or something like that, that people have done like forever. But it's, to a certain degree, I'm kind of like, well, you know, I, if you don't want me in it and I can't relate to it, I'm happy going to a different piece about something else that's,
yeah,
you know, it might be just as good. It just doesn't have the history behind it.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So do either of you have a favorite black playwright, and whether you've done a play that they've written or you've seen or have just read, or you just have knowledge about them that you're just like, or maybe one that you really want to dig into even more.
Pierce, you want to go first?
I would say for me, favorite. So bad when anybody ever asks me what's like my favorite or something. I don't know if I there's definitely some plays that I want to do that are by black playwrights. I don't know if I want to call anybody my favorite person. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would love to do like a Brandon Jenkins piece, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I love An Octoroon, like, you know. I've never done August Wilson. I'd love to do August Wilson. I think those plays are great. I honestly think you could put his stuff right up there with Shakespeare. Shakespeare just has the benefit of being hundreds of years old.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'd love to do Raisin in the Sun. I'd love to do a Susan Laurie Parks.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of great stuff, that I would love to do. You know, I've been fortunate in the last two and a half years to have the majority of the shows I've done have been from black playwrights, which has been really dope. Yeah.
It is. That's why I passed it to you, because I was like, I don't like, there's too many. Like, I don't know if it's like a favorite. Like, Passover by Antoinette Mwandu is amazing. Katori Hall's entire body of work fucking blows my mind. Brandon Jacob Jenkins and Terrell Alpha McCraney.
Yeah.
Because I was sort of like on the other end of, we were in tech for Raisin. So like Raisin went from like, oh, this is a good play to like, no, this is Lorraine Hansberry was so fucking ahead of her time, but also so keyed into every, like, I think that play is also up there in with Shakespeare. There's a moment at the beginning of the play that sort of rang out to me during table work where Walter says, I don't want any eggs, damn the eggs, right? Mm-hmm. And then, but what happens with Ruth later in the play? She gets an abortion.
Yeah.
And I'm like, holy shit. Like, she did the thing that Shakespeare does, which is like layer something innocuous so that your brain starts like free associating. So that by the time you get to abortion, like that eggs moment, you start thinking about all kinds of different eggs whenever he's like, damn the eggs, right? Because it's sort of an existential whatever, but he's definitely talking about breakfast, but you know, human brain is amazing. By the time we get to the abortion, that fucking hits you like a freight train because you've already been thinking about eggs in any context throughout the entire play because you put it at the fucking, in the first 15 minutes. And I'm like, that's incredible. The fact that she's able to understand how the brain works and how audiences work, and how the collective imagination of an audience can kind of go anywhere, and any little piece of information will sort of hold on to until the other shoe drops. I mean, August Wilson as well. Like, I completely agree. He's up there with Shakespeare, if only because he's so unafraid to put on paper the ways in which Black people play with the English language. And how that's evolved over time. Yeah, I mean, there's Susan Lloyd Parks. I mean, like, she's fucking batshit amazing. Like, she's like, like, you read her work and you're like, this person is fucking crazy. But at the same time, it's like, that's how I feel sometimes, you know? Like, she's brilliant. I mean, Top Dog Underdog is out of control. The America plays are out of control. Yeah, I mean, George C. Wolfe, The Colored Museum is a play that I would love to. I mean, there's just so many that, and that's the kind of the thing is that what I love about a lot of Black playwrights is there's always like a foot in the mystic and or the surreal, because that's kind of the Black experience in this country is that like there's a little magic, but there's also just a lot of like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? Like, and you know, it's like every time we, you know, go on Facebook and we see another video, it's kind of like, this is it literally, it's kind of like a Beckett play where we're just like waiting for something to come that will make life a bit better, you know, that will be the answer. But at the same time, we're all just kind of waiting. We're literally just waiting. Or marching, or protesting, or asking for systemic change. But it's that sort of surreal sense of like, what the fuck is going on and when will it end?
And you know, the thing is, I also think if I'm remembering my college education as well as I like to think I am.
You got this.
We didn't really study any of those playwrights.
Yeah, exactly.
Not at least as part of the curriculum. But really the only, it's which is kind of crazy to me that like, you know, I don't think we ever, we may have had one August Wilson as part of theater history, I think. So I think we read Joe Turner. But for the most part, it's like what was said earlier, it's a lot of that like European and, you know, Arthur Miller and things like that.
Yeah. I also think that I got super lucky in that my first human of color as a acting teacher was my first year at Yale. Gregory Wallace took over Ron Van Loo's spot and was just recently appointed the Lloyd Richards Chair of Acting. But he's a queer man of color who graduated in the 80s from Yale. And that was the first time that I had a human of color teaching me acting. And I did not realize until I had him how incredibly important that is. Mm-hmm. As well as having the benefit of, like, you know, August Wilson, his plays were written and first performed at Yale Rep. Lloyd Richards directed all, if not most, of his plays when they were at Yale Rep. And so, like, we had that benefit of it was a part of the curriculum because we would be studying acting in the fucking August Wilson room. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. So I think that it's changing, but also, like, many of the reasons that we are being taught Beckett or Odets or, you know, Chekhov, Shakespeare, Moliere is because that's what your teachers were taught.
Exactly.
They were not taught August Wilson. They were not taught Susan Laurie Parks. They were not taught Antoinette Nwandu or Katori Hall or BJJ or Terrell, because that either A, wasn't available, or B, it just felt too scary, which is the language that they would use is inaccessible. Mm-hmm. Well, really, that's code for this scares the shit out of me, and I'm scared I'm going to get it wrong, and I'm scared that all the Black people I've ever met in my entire life are going to come to my house and smother me like a little baby because I taught August Wilson, or like I performed in, or like I dared to put on Top Dog Underdog at my little fucking college theater in the middle of nowhere, fucking Indiana. Like that's the very real fear. And I think that the only way to override that fear is to hire more brown people.
Yeah. For sure. Thinking about it now, it probably would be kind of weird to have August Wilson taught by your white teacher.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
Well, I have had that experience.
Oh my God. Yeah. Dude, please, do you have video? Like, is there like a Google Drive? Is there like a Dropbox? Like, is there like a Dropbox that we could all access to watch this?
God, I wish I would have recorded.
But you know, at the same time, I've rarely gotten called in for like Chekhov or anything like that. You know what I mean? It's like a lot of those stuff we went over is the stuff that I do. Not that I'm like avoiding it or anything like that. It's just like, you know,
right.
It's like, of what use is this? It's like,
yeah,
unless you're doing that production of the Wendell Pierce did a production of Cherry Orchard a couple of years ago. It must've been a decade now. But the whole premise of it was that the Cherry Orchard was actually like a part of a plantation that was being inherited or passed down to the, descendants of a slave who worked the land. And so like that recontextualization of Chekhov made it a really interesting production. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's so much more opportunity to continue recontextualizing these, I don't even want to say classic works, but these sort of well-worn works, say that three times fast, but to like, to recontextualize these works does open up the spectrum of who can play in these plays. Yeah. And also, it allows us to have a much deeper conversation about the play within its own context, within our context. It's just a much more fruitful conversation. But again, people are scared to let it get messy and complex. Unfortunately, if the American theater has any hope for itself, it needs to get real fucking messy and real complex, and no clean answers should ever be found by the time bows happen. There should be continued conversations in the lobby on the, like, you never want, I think every actor's fear is that, you know, bows happen, people clap, they file out, they get in the car, and they're thinking about what they're going to have for breakfast the next day. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? No, fuck that. I want like a couple that's been married for 30 years to get in a fucking like the fight of their goddamn lives because they had completely different experiences watching a play.
Yeah.
You know, and like we have to get messy with it and we have to start making it complex because that's the state of things right now. Things are complex and things are messy.
Yeah, it's interesting you said that, Brandon, about Wendell Pierce being in Cherry Orchard, because I just did Cherry Orchard my junior year of college, and I played the character who was the son of the servant of, you know, the Cherry Orchard. Mm-hmm. And so as a Black man saying that, you know, I bought the Cherry Orchard where my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather were we're servants, we're indentured servants and slaves, that it has a bigger impact than just a white actor saying those words, you know?
So, yeah, because it kind of gets benign when it's just a white dude. Like, if it's like, if it's going to be done in North America in the 21st century, and you have a white dude saying, this is a land that my, you know what I mean? Like, it just kind of gets weird. Like, cause we all know, like within our context, we're all like, why wasn't that? And then we start thinking about, the wrong shit. Then we start thinking about like, why the fuck didn't they cast it this way? And then we start getting angry over the casting. Yeah. And then we completely like, we're out of the play. You know what I mean? Like now we're just thinking about like, now we're thinking about the meta theatrics of it all. And that's rarely fun for anybody. So like, it's sort of, I'm glad that they had, you know, could see the opportunity there, because a lot of people will gloss over that opportunity in the name of the status quo.
Yeah. Great. So I think this is a good time to talk about now. Both of you, all of us, I'm sure, have had more white directors in our lives than black directors. So do you want to talk to, especially being in a play that is about black life and the black experience, having a white director guiding you through that story, what is that like?
So I did a play my first year of grad school by this playwright from Philly named Josh Wilder. It was called Marty and the Hands That Could. And the way that there's three directors in every class, there's three playwrights in every graduating class at the school. And so they sort of rotate. So it's like your first year, you're paired up with the director's playwright. And then as the years go on, they sort of rotate through until every playwright has hit every director and vice versa. So we were doing a play that was about a family of black people who were affected heavily by different generations of this family were affected by the crack epidemic in different ways. Our director was a British woman who was one of the most brilliant sort of European art experts that I've ever met. So certainly the last person on the planet Earth to direct this play. When I tell you, she did the greatest job of just stepping the fuck back and letting the playwright and the dramaturg who the playwright trusted and the actors sort of find the play. She just stepped back. She was just like, I'm here to, because I can't speak with authority on these issues. And so this is really, as a director, my opportunity to learn. And I was like, well, shit, that's crazy and rare and also awesome. And it turned out to be one of my favorite experiences at the school, simply because she just like stepped back and was like, I have no authority. I can give his really technical notes. And she did, as far as sort of like the pacing of things, or even just like staging of things, the stage picture in many ways. But as far as the content, she really just took a step back and listened, and it was awesome.
Yeah. For me, I mean, I think of the shows I've done as a professional, I think I've only had one that was like a black story written by a black person, but directed by a white person. I did a production of Milk Like Sugar, by Kirsten Greenidge. And I think the theater may have had a situation where they originally had, they were going to go with like a black playwright, I mean, a black director, excuse me. But then either finances or something or other, or that person dropping out, ended up in a situation where the artistic director ended up directing the piece, which Milk Like Sugar is dealing with a young black lady who, her and her friends enter into this pregnancy pack where they're like, one of them's pregnant. They're like, let's all get pregnant. And they're like in high school and whatnot. So, so we're directed in this piece by a white guy, a piece that very much felt like at the very minimum, the director should maybe be a woman. But you know, he's pretty good about it, letting us have our space to sort of like the authorities. And the nice thing about that is all of us want the piece to look a certain kind of way, you know, and we know how it should look in certain ways. So giving us space to be able to articulate that stuff is always great. The thing with that particular piece, I'm not a huge fan of that play, because it's one of those pieces where if you're a Black audience member, you know the story.
Yeah.
And you're familiar with the information it's giving out. But if you're a white audience and you're seeing it, you might just be like, wow, this is amazing. I never knew the kind of stuff that people are dealing with. Oh, my goodness. And so when you have a white director in this case, you know, they can get kind of sentimental about that stuff too. You know what I mean? Because it's not necessarily a new story. Like that play to me is like, someone once made the point of being like, in terms of talking about audience responses, like, yeah, I mean, like, have audiences like just never listened to a rap album before? And this is stories that Black people are familiar with, and we know it. And plus, I didn't really care for the play because it wasn't doing anything for me or telling me anything new or you know, telling me a story I knew in some sort of new or revealing way. But for a lot of white audiences, it was like, I've never known that this was the kind of stuff that's going on. Mm. You know, I couldn't see that from my yacht. And so that made it weird, because it was like the director like loved it. He loved the piece. It was like so important. Not to say the play didn't have important stuff in it, but it was like, it makes me kind of sad in a kind of way. Because I'm like, why don't you know these kind of stuff? Which, you know, it took me a minute to be like, I need to calm down and understand that, like, this is also why this thing needs to be done, because there are all these audiences that don't know this story that should become familiar with it. Not to say that I don't think that there are probably better plays that do that. But doing that play was probably my first time really sort of wrestling with the weird kind of thing of, there are a lot of Black plays that are written for white audiences.
Yes.
Yeah. And sort of wrestling with that thing of like, I want to do plays that are also like for the Black audience, but I also understand why we have to do the plays for the white audience. And it's like, you know, it's unfortunate, and frustrating to a degree, because you want to do those Black plays, but it also doesn't want to feel like it's still just for white people.
Right.
Which I guess is just like, you know, when things get to a better point, that'll balance out. But, you know, how long is that going to take?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the episode. Yeah, so now I want to ask the two of you, and now with this question, you feel free to give the names or certain instances if you like, but you don't have to. But I want to ask, have either of you been targeted in the theater industry, whether it was while you were working in a rehearsal or in a performance, or have heard something, a comment by an audience member where it was an act of racism?
Yes, kind of. I mean, like, I don't know. I don't really. It's one of those things where it's like, when I do hear it, I just kind of answer with, like, it's not my job as the actor to explain myself to you as the audience member. It's not. You take away whatever you fucking brought in. And if you take away something that you brought in with you that needed to change and didn't, that's not fucking my fault. It just means that you are caught up in your own bullshit. And so oftentimes in those situations, I just go, well, I think that reflects more about your point of view on things than it does about me or us in this particular situation. And then that can turn into a whole other conversation, which is great, because then I can just go like, well, I mean, you're kind of proving my point, because you're just spouting bullshit. Like, you're not really saying anything. You're just sort of trying to defend a place that you know deep down is baseless and has no real standing. So sort of the Michelle Obama idiom of when they go low, we go high. Mm-hmm. I've always found to be the most effective. Not to say that it doesn't affect me. It just sort of is one of those things that I'm like, it's not my responsibility to have to explain my experience and or my performance of said experience to anyone, because they're out there in the dark in the audience while I'm up in the light going through it.
Yeah, I don't think I've experienced any that were like aggressively racist incidents.
Yeah.
At least none that I've retained in my memory. I've definitely had a number of microaggressions for sure.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I used to work at the National Constitution Center doing a show there, where we did like these scenes, and it was basically representing, each scene sort of like spoke to a different article of the Constitution, and you were sort of left with, you know, come up with thoughts about how you feel about parts of the Constitution kind of thing for, you know, schools. But I had like a lady come up to me asking, being like, black people, you know, they talk about how much they love Lincoln and, but you know, Lincoln was a Republican and, you know, trying to understand why black people, she wanted to know why black people voted Democrat or liberal or whatnot. Mm. Like, and I heard this one man, Dr. Ben Carson, and I was like, these are conservative thoughts. And she was like, basically asking me to understand why black people voted the way they do, you know, as if I represent all black people.
Yeah, right.
I don't.
Wait, Pierce, you don't?
Nah.
Don't you love that, shit, though? That happens so much.
There's going to be a package arriving at your house, Pierce, and I'm going to have it. Just don't accept the package, okay?
Just don't sign anything.
Because I thought that you, my fault. That's on me.
You'll get it back in like a month.
Perfect.
The second thing about working at the Constitution Center is that they have a policy where you have to be nonpartisan. So, which was also good learning that early in my career, just learning to be able to talk with people. But like, I couldn't even lay into this lady the fact that like the Republican Party's changed. Like, lady, what's wrong with you? Like, also there's also so many economic reasons, and also the party's like switched and all that kind of stuff. But you know, I remember. I did a show with Lindsay Smiling, and we did a production of Metamorphoses. And Lindsay's probably, 3 inches taller than me, 2 inches taller, something like that. Weighs more than I do. In this particular show, he was bald. And in one of the reviews, it talked about Lindsay, but they were really talking about me. Lindsay didn't play that part. I did. Like, why are you? Which I don't know how you can make that mistake. You have a program.
Exactly.
I hate doing talkbacks with audiences, partially because of that. Because it's like,
yes,
I don't know what somebody's going to say that's going to be offensive, and partially because they don't necessarily know it's offensive. You know, like even that same job at the Constitution Center, I remember at one point this guy going off about something, and he was like, and then there are people that blah, blah, blah. And he's like pointing at me, because he was going off about like welfare or something like that. Clearly, he was,
oh my God.
And even at that same job, I once had someone come up and talk to me because I was the only guy in the show as well. People do like weird stuff like that. The best part of that lady who asked me about Lincoln is that she started off her sentence being like, I'm not from the East Coast, which I'm like, are you implying that black people only live on the East Coast of America?
Yeah. Like,
are there no black people in the Midwest? What are you talking about, lady? You when you do those talkbacks and you listen to people, some people say some really like they're trying to hide it, but you can't mistake what they're like actually getting to. You know what I mean? When they're saying things like these people or they're like people, and it's like, you mean non-white people? You know, I don't know. It's talkbacks bum me out.
Yeah.
Especially depending on what the show is, because you know, you learn some stuff about people that
oh yeah,
you wish weren't like, true or whatnot.
You're kind of like hoping that you can get through a talk back and no one says something that'll just piss you off. Cause that's really all it is for me, is I'm just like, I just want to get through this talk back, not like upset that people were stupid. And unwilling to look at themselves. Like that's really, well, why do people like, Lincoln was a Republican. Like, just shut the fuck up. Like, what are you Wikipedia, like this, the internet has all the answers that you're looking for. You just have chosen to not use that power that you have in your pocket. And you've just wanted to embarrass yourself and frustrate me. And that's not fun for anybody involved. So why?
I did a production of Sweat.
Ah.
Yeah, Lynn Nottage.
Yeah, and we had a talk back for it, and there's the one character in that play, Brucey, who's, you know, somebody who's, if I'm remembering the play correctly, the people at his factory, they, like, went on strike and whatnot, and it didn't work out for them. And he ends up becoming a drug addict. And the story, like, makes it very clear that, like, you know, this guy's had a lot of troubles, and that's why he's, like, in the situation he's in now. But, you know, we had a talk back where an audience member was like, all the people seemed like there were no bad people in this play. Well, except for Brucey, the drug addict.
Jesus Christ.
He was, and it's like, what? You know, it's like, did you get the play, buddy?
Right.
And of course, like, our actor who was playing Brucey was like, he got so upset, and he was like, we went back after the talk, but he's like, see, this is why I didn't want to do this show out here with, you know, because the audience that would be out here, you know.
Yeah.
Because that was the kind of audience that they had, you know, who's, you know, you're just judging a character without really trying to understand why it became like that, which is especially funny because there's another character in that play, the white woman who also becomes a drug addict.
Right.
You know?
And doesn't the white dude become like a white supremacist at the end? Like yeah. What do we, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
It's like, what are we talking about, man?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't tell you how many times during ragtime at PSF where you could feel the tension in the room during that talk back. And even during a few shows or many of the shows, that, you know, we're performing this for predominantly white audiences. And when you're seeing black joy on stage, when you're seeing black pain, it's like, how are they reacting to that? And sometimes it was verbal. And sometimes we felt like we didn't hit anything. We felt like, or at least I did as a young black man. I was like 18, 19 years old at the time. So I felt like I wasn't doing enough to get through to them. It's like, why are you coming here to see this story and not feeling or not getting it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, part of that's just, and a lot of that has nothing to do with us and everything to do with who the audience surround themselves with and the sources of information that they choose to ingest. Like, it has nothing to do with your performance or even the play itself. It has, most of it has to do with just a lack of empathy. And that's sort of the sad thing about it, is that, like, it's an opportunity for that empathetic well to be deepened for the audience members, but it's only an opportunity that can be taken if you take it willingly. And if they're unwilling to even go to that well, then it's like, well, you know, I can't do anything for it. None of us can do anything for you until you make the choice to say, as an audience member, maybe I'm wrong. Yeah. And that's a thought that most people are deeply uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a weird thing because some of those audience members, if it's anything to do with the black experience, it's so completely foreign.
Yeah.
Where it's like I did a show, Gabe, we were talking about, I did Skeleton Crew before, and I did that in Maine, and, you know, you go into the show and they had a whole thing trying to relate it to a previous show they did called like The Paper Maker or something like that. to sort of give the audience an access point so that, you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to go see this black show. Oh, but it's like that. Oh, okay. Well, I understood that.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, people have to, I guess, learn to be empathetic, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a muscle more than it is like an inborn sort of gift.
Yeah.
Empathy.
Mm-hmm. So I always like to end my conversations and interviews on a positive note. So I know you both were like, why are you asking me my favorite? I hate doing that. But I want to ask you, like, who's that's like in general, not even specifically an actor, but who do you look up to and who do you admire as a black artist in this world?
Living or dead?
Living or dead.
Amazing.
Well, you know, I part of me kind of hates to say it, but I kind of have to say Donald Glover.
Mm.
I hate saying it because people will come up and be like, you know, who you remind me of, and I'm like, no.
Yeah, I've said that my twin.
The entirety of my professional career. So, which kind of forces you to then like look up to that person because you're like, look at all the things he does. So, definitely, but in truth, I am a fan of Donald Glover. It's people telling me that I look like him that ruined him for me. but yeah, like all the stuff like he does, and you know, especially now, but even like 8 years ago when he was still on Community, even like I remember like getting his mixtapes before he, you know, his rap career really blew up, and I was like, oh man, this guy's really talented. Oh, he used to write 30 Rock too. Oh, and he's on Community, and this guy's gonna blow up, and you know, now he's
he fucking did that.
Yeah. That's oh yeah.
That makes it sound like I started to dislike him because he went mainstream.
You gotta flex your fucking your MC DJ muscles. Be like, I'm not a fucking poser. I was listening to him when he couldn't even pay for fucking Mamoons, guy.
Right. Yeah.
you haven't listened to Cul-de-Sac? So you're not a real fan.
You know what I'm saying? Right. It's like, oh, okay. Like, so you jumped. Do you know about Freaks and Geeks, my guy? Nah, you don't know about that shit, do you? Like, you don't know about him taking.
I knew him before he was Childish Gambino.
That's right. I used to watch it. I watched a video with him in a red hoodie in a fucking factory before This Is America. Yeah.
So yeah, he would definitely be somebody I look up to. He's a talented guy.
I would say that I have two. I don't whatever.
That's fine.
So Viola Davis is definitely one. I think that the way that she looks at the craft is just so refreshing because she looks at it. A lot of artists, I think, sort of look at it as an ego-driven art form. But Viola was the first person that, like, listening to her interviews, she really put into words this feeling I had, which was that this thing, like, acting is a craft. It's the same sort of, it's a trade, much like being a plumber or an electrician. When you go to acting school, you're going to trade school, not art school. And her sensibility that, like, she went to Juilliard because she never wanted someone to look at her and be like, oh, well, she could have like a bad performance, a bad rehearsal, a bad show, a bad movie. But no one could ever look at Viola. No one can ever look at Viola and go like, oh, well, she's not an actor, so that's why she X, Y, and Z. And she never wanted anyone to look at her that way. And so that's why she went through the training that she went to. And every time I watch that, I think it's an interview that she gave when Fences was on Broadway some years back. But just listening to that really always gets me, it makes me fucking cry, man. It's some good shit. Some good shit right there. She speaks the truth often. And the other person is Prince. May forever rest in paradise. Like Prince, I mean, the first time I saw Purple Rain, I was just like, who the fuck is this dude who's willing to wear blouses and like veils over his eyes and like scream on top of the speaker? And is so like, he was sort of Purple Rain in my brain is always like, that was sort of the parting gift of a couple generations of like love songs where men were willing to admit that they were hurt and willing to say, like, there's that song, like, I Wish It Would Rain, where like the guy's like, I'm so sad that if it rained outside, I could go outside and cry as the rain is hitting my face. Or,
Temptations, right?
Yeah. Or even like ain't too proud to beg is like,
right.
It's he's not too proud. Like literally, I'm not too proud to beg to have you back. Mm-hmm. And after Purple Rain, that sort of mentality, that sensitivity, that vulnerability in black male bodies, cisgendered black male bodies, really started to disappear. And so he still stands as like that. So he's still holding the line there, Prince's, and he's a constant reminder that we have to be vulnerable. We have to be, as artists who are choosing to be on stage or on film, we have to be vulnerable, because the stoicism, the sort of Brutus mentality, it didn't work out well for Brutus, and B, is a myth. It's not who we are at our core. I think that we're far more sensitive, and there's just a lot more life underneath the surface if we so choose to cleanse ourselves in the waters of Lake Minnetonka.
That's funny. Hey, this has nothing to do with anything we're talking about. I just think it's interesting. I always think about this, that song, I Wish It Would Rain.
Yeah.
So the guy who wrote that, he wrote three songs for the Temptations. He co-wrote three songs for the Temptations. Mm-hmm. You're My Everything, I Wish It Would Rain, and I Could Never Love Another.
Oh, shit.
And all three of those songs, as I've been told anyway, are about his wife.
Wow.
And I Wish It Would Rain and I Could Never Love Another. The thing is, I think his wife ended up cheating on him and leaving him.
Oh, shit.
And and he actually, I think he killed himself like a week after I Wish It Would Rain was released or something like that. So those songs all have like, they're very real. Like the pain in those songs is very real.
Wow.
Well, damn.
But yeah, there's just a little fun fact. Next time you listen to I Wish It Would
Fun
Rain.
Fact.
Fun, right?
Very fun fact.
Fun fact.
Oh, yeah, thank you for sharing that. My goodness.
Yeah.
Never listened to it the same.
Now,
you know what I mean?
I took things off of the happy note. The Temptations are great.
Yeah. Ain't too proud. Ain't too proud.
Yes. Yeah, you know what I mean? You know, funny story about Tina Turner and Ike. No.
Funny story. Oh man, we love it, especially since they have these musicals coming out about their lives too. So on a final note, this may be a difficult question, I don't know, we'll find out, but what is your biggest wish or your biggest goal as an artist,
Pierce? If you come up with something first, I'm still like gathering.
That's a hard question because I feel like that's an ever-evolving kind of thing.
Sure.
I mean, I guess my biggest wish is, like, at the end of my, like, artistic career that I have, I don't know, satisfies the right word because, to a certain degree, are artists ever satisfied?
Right.
Question of the decade.
but to get to whatever is close to that sort of satisfaction, feeling like you did something that like you had a career that to you felt, or to me, I guess I'm talking about myself, felt close to satisfying or impactful to some degree.
Like, yeah, go ahead.
I was just gonna reiterate it. Like, yeah, just like when I'm dying, I can be like, yeah, I did some stuff that I'm really proud of.
Yeah.
I think in a similar note, I sort of had this working theory that started last summer at PSF, went through a really bad breakup, 10 out of 10 would not recommend going through a bad breakup and working on two shows at the same time. And a kid's show. Just wouldn't recommend going through a breakup while you're doing all those things. Well, a kid's show version of Mackers, of all things. Yeah. Really, really put some color onto Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, let me tell you.
Oh, man.
But this theory I had was that I think that every human being is born as an incomplete puzzle, and none of us are born with the box art that tells us what the picture should look like. And also in this jumble of puzzle pieces that we're born with, we have some pieces that don't fit. And so we spend our lives exchanging puzzle pieces with other people. You know, maybe we'll give them a piece of our puzzle that fits theirs. Maybe they'll give us a piece that doesn't quite fit ours, but might fit someone else's. And I think that similarly, I would like to be on my deathbed and someone asks me, how did the puzzle go? And I would like to say that I have, you know, 80% of my, that's being generous, 80% of my puzzle completed, but I gave away more pieces than I received. And I would like, that would be a really cute thought. I mean, we'll see, but
yeah, we'll see.
I think that's the wish.
Yeah. I definitely want to keep just like, every time I do a show, I want to feel like I'm growing in some sort of way.
Totally.
And feel the older I've gotten, the more I've been like, I want to put my artistic stamp on this. Yeah, but it's ever evolving, whatever the goal of the moment is, you know?
Yeah. And yeah, also, absolutely. And as Brandon, as Pierce said, like, you know, there's if you're doing every play or every show and you're not learning something new about either yourself or the world in which we live, then something is wrong, either in the artistry or in the hierarchy of where your ego lies in the storytelling. But I really do feel like our job is less about us and more about the story and more about, like, our job isn't to feel anything really. Our job is to tell a story. If we happen to feel things along the way, that's fantastic. But ultimately our job is to tell the stories and to learn from them, because that's how we sort of become wider and deeper as human beings.
Great. Yeah, that's wonderful from both of you. Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen, so much for this conversation. It has been very wonderful. Yeah, anytime I talk to Black men who are in the industry, I just feel better about, you know, what I'm dedicating my life to, because yeah, it's definitely a commitment, and it's you have to love it. That's what I love.
Yeah, because the shit ain't easy. Let me tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not easy.
No.
But occasionally it's fun, and that's what we do it for.
Yeah. You know, I realized when I, one of my first shows that I did, because I was doing a tour for schools and stuff like that, is that if I can just reach one person, that can still be, have an impact, because you don't know how many people they'll reach, and you know.
Yeah. I mean, something that I think it was the artistic director of Theater Exile said to me that has stuck with me forever is that, our art will never change the world. It is impossible for the work that we do to change the world. The only thing we can do is change hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. And that really fucking blew my mind, because I was like, oh, well, shit. Like, to Brandon, to Pierce's point, like, all we can do is change one heart and mind, or mind. If we change multiple, that's amazing. But if we can change one through the run of a show, then we did good work.